statement. There is some difference in the Northwest Territories in this regard. I referred briefly to some of the sections in the COPE agreement, which gives those people particular access to resource development decision-making processes. More recently, there has been extensive discussions and negotiations going on in the Northwest Territories about a land use planning process. The net result, I feel, is a very strong role for Northern, and in particular Northern Native people in the Northwest Territories in resource development decision-making. Without going into the detail, although the ultimate decision rests with the federal minister and the territorial ministers, the respective ministers, on the approval of land use plans, the fact remains that the commissions that develop those land use plans for the ministers are dominated by Northern Native people. Secondly, the policy committee, which advises the ministers, is made up of senior bureaucrats and Northern Native people in equal proportions. And of course, some of the senior bureaucrats are resident in the North and working for ministers who are also Northern Native people. So I think there's a different light that can be put on this question in the Northwest Territories. It would appear, although the program is not up and running, it is getting prepared for that, it would appear in the Northwest Territories that clearly we have a mechanism where, for the first time, people in the North, and in particular Native people, will have a very strong influence on the way land use patterns and resource development patterns are to occur.
Thank you. Harvey?
I might comment. I would be hopeful of that, and that sounds like a real step forward from what exists anywhere else. But my experience is that the qualification I would have to make, and my experience is that the Minister of the Environment gets overruled when major government policy is at stake, and large-scale developments do mobilize major government policy.
I should mention, though, Harvey, that in this case, it doesn't report to the Minister of Environment. The Land Use Planning Commission reports to our minister, as well as a minister of Indian Northern Affairs, who is the land manager and the land owner presently in the Northwest Territory. So I think that's one major difference.
Marie Adams?
I think it's an interesting approach that the Canadians have taken in terms of the Cree. I'd like to understand a little bit better about the allocations of money and why they were started in the first place. He said they started giving them money to enable them to go out and subsist in what was the perceived problem in people not being able to go out and subsist. Were their lands being taken from them, or were they afraid of having their lands taken from them?
Yeah, okay. The first payments were not really intended to help subsistence as such. They were, in the 1940s, the government set up the equivalent of, I guess, what's called Social Security here. They set up payments to families for their children, family allowances and things like that. And those started to be paid to Native people, and Native people used them to help them hunt. I think there were two reasons why that was critical. One was that there had been competition for the fur resources, which were the critical source of income in the southern James Bay area, with non-Native trappers, and the resources had been trapped out. And so people had very little cash incomes, very small cash incomes in the 1940s, and then in the late 1940s, and then the world fur price declined. And so what was going on was that people had a standard of a pattern of hunting that depended on a standard of cash income that was modest, but they found that even that modest dependence on cash was being eroded by depleting game resources and declining world fur prices. And so I'm not sure if that's what you're asking, but that's why those payments became critical to them. And although they were very modest payments, by the standards of other Canadians, they were very significant payments, accounting for sometimes 50% of the total cash income of a native village was coming through the government payment schemes. And so that's practically how it happened. I'm not sure if I understand all of what you're asking, Marie, and if I haven't, please come back. But my sense is that people have always been dependent on some amount of cash. The fur trade usually provided it, but under world economic cycles and under the cycles of animals, there are times when there wasn't enough cash, and government payments have come to fill that gap, and people have tried to make those payments stabilize in a way that allows it to reduce their dependence on the world economy and the world fur price.
Well, yesterday in your first presentation, that's what I thought I understood was the payments were to enable them to go out and live a subsistence way of life. You're saying that it enabled them, even though that wasn't the original intent, to be able to go out.
The original intent of the first government payments in starting in the late 1940s was not to help them subsist. It was just to give them the benefits of other citizens and prove that they were Canadians.
You said Social Security, and I think that you meant welfare, because I think in both countries, welfare is what is given to people who, whether they're 60 or 65 or 70, even if they're 30 or 40, welfare is what you get when you're not working and you don't have any source of money and you need money. And that's welfare, and you get it because you're not working. These payments, under the agreement the Cree have, are made for people to go out and work on the land. So in that sense, it seems to me, though they may have originated, the cash flow may have originated out of welfare, the people then wanted them cash flow stabilized and continued, not so that they could stay home and do nothing, but so that they could go out on the land. If that's putting it fairly.
I think it is. I think that's precisely what the Cree say. They don't feel this is a welfare scheme at all. They see it as something that replaced a welfare scheme with a provision for cash that now it only responds to their willingness to work and conduct their own activities that they want to pursue. And they see it as a recognition of the value of those activities also by the government, rather than as a denigration of the value of those activities.
There was another, Chuck, and then Weaver.
Harvey, you mentioned the new government structure that was developed over a period of 6 years. I wondered if there were any other new forms of organization that were developed over this time period that weren't anticipated at the beginning, but possibly derived from the relative lack of limitations and constraints that were negotiated in the original agreement.
The two that stand out in my mind, I think there have been a lot, the two that stand out in my mind are or three maybe. One is housing. The James Bay Agreement says nothing about housing, except that the Cree will continue to get the kind of funds that are available to other Native people to support housing. But the Cree have invested heavily in housing and have set up the various local housing committees and building corporations to manage the actual construction, so that they've reconstructed most of their villages. That's one kind of form. It involves a local committee to control the activity and articulate the need, and involves a formal corporate type structure to actually develop plans, buy supplies, and organize the construction. A more close to the ground and not so formal system, I think, is a system of what are called hunters and trappers committees, which are really new committees of these men who are the owners of hunting territories. And they, because of the new interface through this joint committee with the government over wildlife, the Cree have had in the villages to start getting together much more formally and talking about what issues they'd like to see raised at that joint committee, what responses they'd like to make to the advice that comes down from it. And so there's been a sort of a formalization, in a sense, into a committee form of leadership at the local village level among the owners of hunting territories. And then thirdly, there's been various kinds of economic development plans where I think the Cree have started to try and build economic development enterprises in ways that respect Cree views of decision-making and authority, and also that respect Cree views of the autonomy and responsibility of individuals, so that you get what to me are very unusual things, like the village, the community I know best, is set up commercial forestry operation, and it's bought the timberjacks, and it's set up so that the men who run those machines buy them over 5 years, and the idea is that they will become operators of timberjacks that are no longer tied to the village forestry operation, but will be free to enter all kinds of employment in the region where there are other opportunities. And so it's an interesting combination of a village controlled and benefiting the village development, yet it's also setting up individual people with the skills and resources that they need to be autonomous and to either continue to work for the village or to work for other people if they want. So I think all kinds of things are being explored and created in the process.
Did you have a question, Weaver?
Yes, I did. You were talking earlier about the Indian Affairs dollars being channeled through, I'm not sure if it was the regional government or the corporation, for them to spend with a minimal amount of interference from the government on programs. What came to my mind was back when the Bureau of Indian Affairs were operating schools in the bush here in Alaska, the school board was purely advisory, and the money was channeled through the administrators of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And then things changed a few years back where the school boards in the villages became a school board, and the money went directly from Washington, D.C. to the school board in the villages, and that was operating very well, but of course the funds were cut. When the program operates so well, it seems like that's what happens. My question was, you know, how is that operating in Canada right now? I know it's just started. Is that money going directly to the regional government? Is that going to the villages themselves? Or
right. Almost all of the service institutions, the school, the health and hospital boards, are regional for the Cree and then separate regional ones for the Inuit. And they get their funding directly from the government to the Cree regional organization, and then it channels funds to its local institutions. The regional board is made up of representatives from each of the 8 or 13 communities for the Cree and Inuit respectively, and the board decides how the funds will be allocated. So there is a funding decision at the regional level. The key thing, I think, in terms of being cut off is that the province is legally obliged by the James Bay Agreement to transfer the funds necessary for the operation of these boards. There have been a lot of fights over it, and for a period of a few years, the province actually claimed that the health board was not being properly administered and therefore put it under trusteeship, which in effect retook control of it without cutting off the funds explicitly. But there was a court action to terminate that trusteeship, and it was terminated, so that the basic idea was to try and prevent or reduce to the minimum the government's ability to cut or control those funds once they were passed on. And with the exception of that confrontation, it's worked, but the possibility of confrontation remains. So
there's a perhaps I might be allowed to say something at this point, Harvey, that we've heard about, I think, from all of the regions of Arctic and subarctic Canada comparable in latitude and geography and in the extent of their native populations comparable to Alaska. But whereas in Alaska you had in 1971 really one settlement for that applied to the whole state, in Canada, because experience has been year by year and region by region, you have a variety of settlements, and perhaps it might help to put it in context if I were to say that the first settlement in 1975 in James Bay in northern Quebec was within a province, province being the same thing as a state. And there were two settlements, one by the Inuit and one by the Cree, and the Inuit were to be here, except that they had to remain in Quebec to direct the salvage operation of the caribou herd. And Harvey's been talking about the arrangements made under those two settlements. Where the Inuit live in Quebec, they are then the majority by a ratio of 4-1 over whites. So they have a public government which they dominate. In the Cree area, they are in a minority, so they have an ethnically defined government under which they govern their own communities and their own affairs and their own land. But there is, coexisting with it, a white, I shouldn't say white, but you know what I mean, a public regional government, non-native. You use that expression here. We are more inclined in Canada just to say white and get it over with, spit it out. But then we have two territories, that is two jurisdictions of Canada that are still territories, as Alaska was prior to 59. And in the Yukon, as Dave Porter and Victor Matander told us, the native people constitute about 6,000 in number, making them perhaps 25% of the population. So they are a minority. In the Northwest Territories, which is the one-third of all Canada, 1,300,000 square miles of territory, you have a public government that is dominated by native people. They are the majority in the Northwest Territories. They run the government. The head of government is a native. The majority of ministers are natives. Hugh Monahan's own minister, to whom he reports, is a native person. And there, that government is a party to negotiations between the federal government and the native peoples living there to work out their land settlements. So they have a territorial government that they are very influential in that is sympathetic, I think it's fair to say, to the land claims proposals being put forward. And you have three land claims proposals there. One, the COPE agreement, already signed this year, and then you have the Dene claim in the Mackenzie Valley, and then the Inuit claim in the Eastern Arctic, where the majority of Inuit live. Forgive me, I just thought I'd frame the remarks we've heard, because that's why you get all these different ideas, depending on what works and what people want to do. And all of them, I think, it's fair to say, have looked at Alaska, at ANCSA, adopted some ideas, the idea that native people should get into business, for instance, but rejected what seemed to be the main features of ANCSA, that is the corporations they have in Canada are, all of them, membership corporations where there is no possibility of sale of shares. Your membership ends when you die. When you are born into the tribe or the village, you become a member, and so there is not the deep-seated problem. I think everybody acknowledges it to be a problem of the afterborns or new natives that you have here. The other thing is that I think in all of their agreements they've managed to work them out so that undeveloped native lands are not and never will be taxable. And that's something that's a problem here. I think those features are common throughout the Canadian settlements, no matter which jurisdiction you happen to be speaking of. Now, there are settlements being worked out in southern Canada, in the provinces, but we don't want to go into those. It becomes even more confusing, and I should add, far more difficult for the native people, that's why we've restricted the discussion to those settlements and claims that bear a very large resemblance to what the situation is in Alaska. Just before we move on to Dan Gross, I was going to ask Peter Usher, who is familiar with all of these settlements and who studied the James Bay and Northern Quebec settlement for me back in about 77 and 78, whether there's any comment you wanted to add to what Harvey has said, Peter.
Specifically about James Bay?
Well, anything arising out of what Harvey said that you think might be useful to add.
I think Harvey's been so exhaustive, I'm not sure it would be useful for me to do that, really.
Well, that's, you're a man in a thousand, that's all I can say. Well, perhaps we could move on to Dan Gross and let him talk about some of these third world settlements, and then, it being Saturday, I thought we might have a mid-morning coffee break. I don't know whether I should say third world settlements, but subsistence in the third world.
Thank you very much, Justice Berger. I want to take this opportunity to thank you for having invited me to be here and to express my appreciation to all of you for the absolutely singular learning experience which you have provided for me, someone whose experience has been primarily in the South American tropics. Quite a far fetch from the environment surrounding Anchorage and points north. And I feel, I guess, some obligation to try to justify my presence here, and I'd like to mention a couple of areas in which I might share just a bit of my own experiences and some of my thoughts on the subject of native subsistence in other parts of the world. I feel it's a very heavy burden to try to discuss these topics for the entire third world, although I think the designation third world is an apt one and a useful one when we come to these topics for reasons which I will come to presently. So I'm going to try to very briefly achieve two objectives, one of which is to make you aware of the struggle of indigenous peoples elsewhere in the world to maintain their identity and to preserve their habitat and the subsistence activities which are so integral to their way of life. And secondly, I'd like to look very briefly at some of the approaches to subsistence systems elsewhere in the world, especially at a particular factor which I think has not received as much emphasis as perhaps it deserves, and that is the interaction between subsistence activities and other activities, many of which articulate with other features of the societies in which native subsistence societies find themselves embedded. And in developing these ideas, I think it would be important to keep two ideas in mind. These are ideas of mine, and I'd like to make them, to persuade you that they are worth thinking about. First of all, I think it's understandable that we should look at subsistence as an entity in itself, and subsistence activities and the relationship that native peoples have to subsistence. I think there is some danger, though, that of thinking of subsistence as a separate sphere and thinking of native peoples as living in a different world because they practice a subsistence economy, as if it were insulated from and isolated from the modern market economy of the nations in which these people live, and as if it were isolated from the modern technological changes which have occurred in these countries. Second of all, I want to suggest that we've been talking largely in terms of fairly abstract notions of subsistence. We've been using concepts like management. And I want to suggest that it's also important, perhaps not at a conference like this, but in other contexts, to look at subsistence in the actual context in which subsistence decisions are made, choices among alternatives are made by individuals, by households, and by entire communities. When it comes right down to it, subsistence does not take place around conference tables or in community meetings or at fish and game board meetings, but it takes place in communities where people have to make decisions about how they are going to make a living. And while the restriction of the term subsistence to living off the wild produce of the land is certainly an adequate one for certain purposes, I think we also have to recognize that the term has another connotation, and that is making a living, what it is that brings food to a person's table. And that, I suppose, stresses again the notion that it is useful to look at subsistence in the total context in which it exists. First of all, I'd like to just point out very briefly that there are many other areas of the world where there are, aside from the circumpolar regions of the world, where there are highly subsistence-oriented societies. If we restrict ourselves to those who rely primarily on wild resources as opposed to domesticated resources, we can still find a large number of societies on different continents who rely on these resources for a good deal of their daily subsistence. We find them in the central deserts of Australia, find them on several of the islands and archipelagos of Indonesia, such as Irian Jaya and Sumatra. We find them in Papua New Guinea. We find numerous subsistence societies in South America, mainly in Amazonia, in southern and eastern Africa, and finally in pockets in India, China, and Southeast Asia. Now, if we expand our definition of subsistence societies to those who also cultivate or herd for a living, but who are indigenous to a particular region, and who practice an economy which is primarily aimed at satisfying their own needs, we would have to expand our geographical scope even more, because most of the populations of Asia, Southeast Asia, a great deal of the population of Latin America and Africa would come under this heading. These are not simply peasant peoples, but that is one very common term used to apply to these people. And they have a great deal in common with the subsistence producers in the more narrow or restrictive sense of people who rely on wild game and other wild products. Now, as it happens, most of the areas of the world where people do rely primarily on wild resources are areas which are not or have not been historically demanded for the purposes of agriculture. And these are virtually the only areas left on the Earth's surface where subsistence, that is to say, hunting-gathering societies still remain. Almost all of the subsistence societies in the world are found, with exceptions of those in North America and Australia, are found in underdeveloped countries or third world countries. These are countries which are characterized by a set of conditions which contrast very sharply with those in North America. In these countries, there's a relatively low level of industrialization. The average incomes are quite low. Standards of living tend to be low. There are very sharp inequalities of wealth and control over resources. And many of these countries are engaged in a struggle to develop. And in doing so, and in attempting to develop themselves, one of the primary focuses of their activities is the development of natural resources, so that the process of development, and some people would prefer to put that term in quotes, or modernization in third world countries almost invariably results in clashes between the maintenance of an adequate habitat and environment for subsistence activities and the attempts to develop these underdeveloped economies. Another factor that I think that is useful to remember when we look at the third world subsistence societies is the fact that these are societies in which there are frequently very large populations and frequently rapidly growing populations, rural populations in the main, although some of these countries are urbanizing at a very rapid rate. Still, these countries have, as one of their development objectives, the provision of employment and adequate resources for these large rural non-indigenous populations. This would be particularly the case in Latin America. And this can also result in conditions of conflict between subsistence-oriented indigenous peoples and the other rural populations who are very often find themselves in situations of extreme need. It sometimes leads to situations in which the interests of the rural masses seem to be in conflict with those of the subsistence-oriented indigenous populations. And this has resulted in some very, very unfortunate and sometimes tragic conflicts in third world countries. Now let me talk briefly in a sort of schematic way, I hope this won't come across like a laundry list, as about some of the interactions between subsistence and the broader social and economic systems in which subsistence economies or subsistence-oriented peoples find themselves ensconced today. And I think that this could be helpful, even though some of the particular conditions to which I will refer don't occur in the Arctic. Nevertheless, many of them do, and I think all of them might help us to think about some of these interactions between subsistence and non-subsistence activities, which I want to make one of the contributions which I make today. First of all, I think it's that on the most fundamental level, all subsistence activities require time. They require the time of people who go out from their homes and seek subsistence resources. Sometimes it takes a great deal of planning and preparation, and then the actual subsistence quest, as we've seen in many of the illustrations here, require time. And it requires very often that time be devoted to subsistence activities during specific seasons of the year. Now, this simple fact means that subsistence activities, either on a daily basis or on a seasonal basis, are frequently going to conflict with other activities, such as wage labor, such as production for the market, such as school schedules, such as the requirements that subsistence producers attend meetings, very often meetings having to do dealing with the regulation of their own habitats and their own societies. So that wherever there are other activities present in the villages and settlements of subsistence peoples, there is a potential for conflict between the time needed for providing subsistence and time needed to attend to other activities. If we turn to the requirements that subsistence peoples have, if we look at some of these requirements, we find that many of them can potentially lead to trade-offs or decisions between subsistence activities and non-subsistence activities. I'll mention some of them. Perhaps the most basic requirement, which we've referred to frequently here at this meeting, has been the nutritional requirement. Subsistence people are no different from any other people. They have basic nutrient requirements. They need certain numbers of calories, vitamins, minerals, and proteins in their diets. And these requirements cannot be reduced below a certain level, and they cannot be deferred beyond a very limited point. So that nutritional requirements must be met. And one, perhaps the first level at which subsistence decisions are made is at the nutritional level. Beyond that, there are social and ceremonial requirements made of subsistence producers. in many of the societies around the world with which I'm familiar with, the decision to engage in subsistence production is not simply not based purely on the demand for nutrients or the need for nutrients, but on social requirements, which possibly are driven by ritual or ceremonial considerations. So that we find in South America, for example, many hunts are organized, collective hunts particularly, to be able to realize certain ceremonials. And this is a very important and integral part of the lives of these particular subsistence producers. A third requirement that subsistence producers have universally is the acquisition and maintenance of equipment and supplies. And I think that's been mentioned here. I won't go into it. Fourth, we have the requirement to compensate for any deficits which may be incurred. If people stay at home and don't hunt or don't gather for a given period for some other purpose, there has to be an alternate source of nutrients in order to compensate for those nutrients which were lost. Then there are requirements in modern communities for health, for education, for clothing, for recreational facilities. There are requirements on many subsistence peoples around the world today that they pay taxes, fees, and that they purchase permits. In many cases, permits have to be purchased in order for them to engage in their subsistence activities, which I believe we've heard some mention of that here as well. Transportation is a major requirement for subsistence peoples, and it is a major determinant of the choices or trade-offs which subsistence-based peoples must make in order to acquire the vehicles and fuel for these vehicles. And finally, I think it might be useful to mention that another requirement that is placed on virtually all subsistence producers nowadays, and it would seem to be a very stiff requirement in this particular part of the world, is the requirement for representation on decision-making bodies. I've been astounded at sitting here listening to some of the discussion at the number of different kinds of boards and committees and commissions and decision-making bodies in which people participate. And I hope it won't be regarded as impertinent for me to say, well, I wonder whether some of this obviously necessary participation doesn't interfere with some of the activities that we've been talking about. I find it hard to imagine that it would not. And that's a very heavy price to pay in order to be able to go on to be a subsistence producer. Now, when we look at the interaction between social organization, various kinds of social groupings in subsistence, we find that there are many kinds of interaction. The very form of the household and the community is related to subsistence because, as I've learned here in the last few days, there are in this part of the world, as in many other parts of the world, the performance of subsistence activities requires the formation of certain kinds of groups. Communities and households cannot fall below certain critical limits, and in some cases then they cannot rise above certain limits in terms of size and in terms of their composition by age and by sex without becoming unable to perform their subsistence activities because of the necessity that subsistence imposes. We find that in some cases subsistence imposes a kind of a solitary activity, that it requires people to spend long periods of time alone. And this, of course, can conflict with and interact with numerous other requirements of that subsistence regimes impose that I've mentioned. That's on the level of production. When we look at the level of distribution and consumption, we also find a number of interactions between social organization, the way in which people organize themselves, and subsistence. In many cases, the productivity of individual hunters or households varies considerably from time to time, and this is smoothed out by sharing among households, so that the sharing or pooling or dividing of resources is a central feature of subsistence-based societies everywhere in the world, and it also imposes some very important limits on the size and the organizational features of these communities. I'm just going to very briefly go through some of the other features that I think should be looked at when we look at subsistence. We have to look at markets, because increasingly, in virtually all the subsistence societies of the world are encapsulated within market-based societies, market-oriented societies, in which every commodity, from land to labor to subsistence products themselves and byproducts of subsistence, such as furs, equipment, supplies, food, even sport and recreational activities, is negotiated in a market. And in each case, in every market fluctuation, wherever there's, for example, an increase in the value of one of these resources, it has an impact on a subsistence community. If there's an increase in the value of a product that subsistence producers produce, such as the increased demand for turtles to make turtle soup to supply the European and North American gourmet market, had a heavy impact on the Mosquito Indians of Nicaragua in recent years, and it ended up by, depriving them of this resource as a subsistence resource and making it purely a market commodity with enormous impacts on that particular society. So that I don't think there are any cases today that I'm aware of where you can ignore the impact of markets for many kinds of products, for labor, for commodities, and so on subsistence. And finally, we have to look at, and this is what we've been doing basically here, at the impact of state and capital on subsistence economies. We have to look at investment policies, taxation policies, subsidies, the construction of infrastructure by states, and when I refer to states in a generic sense, not simply states of the union here, and in enforcement. And then, of course, the other feature that has an enormous impact on subsistence everywhere, that we find impinging on subsistence economies increasingly everywhere in the third world, are the kinds of capital expenditures and capital projects which involve habitat modification. And under these, we can list some things that are very familiar to you all, such as logging, hydro development, mining and drilling, both offshore and onshore. But in addition to that, we should include grazing and plantation agriculture when we deal with other regions of the world. And these have had enormous impacts on the subsistence economies of peoples elsewhere in the world. Now, let me now shift gears a little bit, having provided that sort of schematic overview of what I think are some of the important issues in looking at the relationship between subsistence and the external economies and societies in which they live. Let me, if time permits, turn very briefly to an examination of the situation of subsistence producers in Brazil, which is the country that I'm most familiar with. I'll try to be very brief here, but I think there are a few interesting points which might come out from this discussion. Brazil was discovered by Europeans in the year 1500, at which point there were anywhere from 3 to 7 million indigenous peoples living within the boundaries of what is today Brazil. By 1900, that number had shrunk to perhaps 400,000. Today, if we look at the tribally organized village-dwelling indigenous peoples in Brazil and attempt to census them, we would probably come up with a figure which is not much greater than 120,000. The loss of population is due to a number of factors, but primarily to mortality, particularly because of introduced disease, because of warfare with Europeans, and because of, and the other major factor would be assimilation, in which indigenous groups have simply ceased to be indigenous groups for, in cultural terms, and have assimilated with the majority population of the country. The economy of subsistence producers in Brazil is characteristically based on horticulture, Sweden horticulture, also known as slash and burn, hunting, fishing, and gathering. The early history of indigenous settlement of indigenous contact in Brazil with Europeans is a history of many tragedies, of missionization, of forced resettlement, of genocidal attacks on indigenous groups, such that entire regions of the country were became completely devoid of native populations, such as the eastern coast of the country, where there are virtually no native groups to be found today, and where the majority of the national population lives. The national population of Brazil today is in excess of 130 million people. So when you look at the percentage of indigenous people to that national population, you realize that there is an overwhelming disproportion, because indigenous peoples, according to the definition that I gave, constitute only 0.1% of the national population. The first glimmerings of a formal Indian policy in Brazil emerged around 1910 as the result